Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Now, today we are going to go over traumatic brain injuries. Now, this is a little bit sort of not what we're used to doing on this podcast. We're going into more of a clinical deep dive today, and we've brought along a fantastic guest who can help us with this. So we're going to have a chat to Sam, who runs Prep Medic, and he's going to introduce himself a little bit so that you guys can get to know him a little bit better.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Like you said, my name's Sam. I'm a paramedic out in Colorado. I'm currently on a flight service, so I'm a critical care paramedic for them, and then a special operations medic with a team up in northern Colorado that does search and rescue, some austere stuff, and then SWAT medicine.
That's awesome. So you obviously get your fair share of trauma in that role, I'm guessing?
Yeah, a fair amount of it for sure.
Well, we'll get into TBIs, and I know that everywhere around the world, everyone will have different protocols on managing these, but today is just more about, I guess, a generalized sort of overview, and if there is specifics, definitely refer to your ambulance services protocols for those. But hopefully we can get a fantastic overview today. So Sam, we'll start off basically at the start. So what is a TBI? What are the types of it?
Sure. So TBIs, our understanding of TBIs has evolved a lot in the last 30 years or so. You know, we used to look at a traumatic brain injury and say, you know, that was your major bleed. So that's going to be your epidural, your subdural bleeds. And that's really what constitutes a TBI. And as we learn more, as we do a lot more research in the combat arena, in the sports arena, on what people are facing, we're really finding that a TBI is a humongous term, which encompasses everything from the most minor of concussions up to, you know, a subdural hematoma causing, you know, a 5-inch or 5-centimeter midline shift. So it's really everything in between there. And really where it starts is that concussion, which we don't know a whole lot about. So with your concussions, I think that's the next on the list there. A concussion is basically, we don't know what it is. We don't know how it's defined. So when you have a concussion, we're basically calling it a head injury of some kind that has a neurologic or motor deficit or symptoms with no finding on radiologic scans. We don't see anything by just putting them in a CT scan. You'd put them in and be like, hey, they're fine. Put them out. So that's when you're knocked on the ground, you see stars, that's probably going to be a concussion. And those are graded. Everybody grades them a little bit differently. And I'll be honest, I don't do a whole lot in the sports medicine field. So generally speaking, if somebody says, hey, I got knocked out, I'm going to say that's at the very least a concussion, but obviously it could grow a little bit from there. And then the other thing we know about those concussions is that they're cumulative. So, you know, where this becomes a huge deal, you know, in the US, at least, you know, your pro sports teams getting paid a ton, you know, they get hit a lot and they get concussions. They can kind of make those choices, but you know, kids coming into that, you know, hit repeatedly over the course of their career, having, you know, 5-10 concussions by the time they're out of their, high school years can have significantly detrimental effects down the road. And a lot of times those are not necessarily, what we would like think of. It's not like unilateral weakness and, you know, things like that. It's usually like severe depression, mood changes. My own brother was in a car accident. He had had a couple concussions, had a concussion, this car accident, and for a good 2 years after that was a completely different person, had a lot of anger issues, had a lot of depression and a lot of weight gain associated with that. So that's really kind of where it starts, in my mind at least.
When it comes down to it, so as we know, as you've just explained, there's a wide range of what a traumatic brain injury can be, that from being concussion all the way through to subdural hematoma or subarachnoid, whatever it may be. So how do we go about doing a neurological assessment that covers all the things that we need to and make sure we're not missing sort of any red flags?
So I think that's a broad question. It really depends on where you're working. So in EMS, or at least in my realm, we're not really doing event standbys so much. We're not there, you know, doing assessments to see if a kid can go back in and play or anything. And your assessment's going to change if you're in that specialized role. For me, as a paramedic in an emergency role, we're really looking at a number of things right off the bat. And the first and foremost, as you walk up to the patient, is going to be how they're positioned and what their mental status is. So, you know, we're doing that, AVPU at the very low end, low yield of the spectrum. Are they alert to verbal, painful, or completely unresponsive? And then we're going to dive in a little bit more to that, is like, what is their Glasgow coma scale? So we're looking at a minor injury between anything between 13 and 15. We're looking at moderate between 9 and 12, and severe, anything less than 8. And with the Glasgow coma scale, and I think what for me in my career has been the biggest assessment finding that kind of predicts how serious this is going to be, is how are they postured on the ground. So tons of people lose consciousness, and like we said, that could be a concussion and they're going to be fine, or that could be, you know, a horrible head bleed that's going to eventually end their life. But if you're looking at the patient and you're looking at how they're postured on the ground, that's pretty high yield. So, you know, you've got your decorticate posturing, which is in towards them. And I kind of remember that that's the better of the two, because they have that animal instinct to protect their core organs. They're in that fetal position, or they're kind of bringing everything in. And then you have the decerebrate posturing, which is the one worse from that. Obviously, you know, completely flaccid's the worst, but where they're kind of stretched away from their core and they're not really protecting anything. And that's much more indicative of those high spinal injuries forms. So Glasgow coma scale's a huge thing. Now, if you want to go another step further in that, you know, your standard stroke assessments do have a place. You know, you can look for that unilateral weakness, everything like that. You can start doing some cranial nerve assessments, and I'll be honest, I don't do a ton of them, but most of us in practice do at least some cranial nerves. You know, you'll have them look at a pen, you'll move to either side, you'll go up and down right there. That's a great assessment. Have them shrug their shoulders, things like that. And then once we kind of get everything we can see, obviously there's some reflexes you can do, but I don't think it has a lot of application in the emergency realm. Once you get done with the things you can see, like right off the bat, then we're going to start doing like our poking and prodding. So, you know, feeling their head, see if there's any depression, things like that, looking into their pupils, seeing if they're reactive. You can do those stroke scales if you want. But for me, that's the main neuro assessment I'm going to do. And if they're conscious, there's a lot more you can go into with it. You know, look at their problem solving, their reasoning, how many cents in a quarter, how many quarters in a dollar, like ask them to solve some simple questions, have them remember something right away. You'll talk to them and be like, hey, I want you to remember purple elephant house. And then in, you know, 10 minutes, you know, ask them what it was. But that's really where I start on any of these assessments. And the one thing I should mention is that your rule outs are huge for them. So having a blood glucose is imperative. I've definitely been landed in the helicopter before for a severe injury, you know, Glasgow coma scale 3, and then it turns out their blood sugar was, you know, 20. So, you know, getting those rule outs, making sure it's not something else going on that we need to intervene on.
Absolutely. That's a really fantastic overview of how to approach assessment and examination. And so I guess then if you got moving away from that sort of concussion side of things, and you've definitely got a patient there who say, you know, they've got an altered GCS, they're unconscious at that point, they, you know, have that boggy mass, they've got a mechanism of injury that would suggest that they do potentially have that TBI. How do we then go about starting to sort of think about managing that? Is there any sort of, I guess, priorities for you that you would go, okay, I need to do this now?
I mean, the priorities, I would assume it's the same in Australia as it is for us. You know, you're looking at your massive hemorrhage, airway, breathing, circulation. And that really in TBIs is what it comes down to for what I would say is the most important. There's a statistic that I read, and there was a study done, and they found that for every 1 moment of hypoxia, so anything under 90% on your SpO2, the patient has a 40% higher mortality. So that is substantial for me. So like first and foremost, clear their airway, make sure they're breathing adequately, make sure they have good oxygen exchange, and you know, don't be afraid to turn on that high flow O2 for them right away until you can get a handle on what's really going on for them. Something we'll oftentimes see in severe head injuries is going to be your abnormal respirations. I think we'll get into that later, but you know, your Shane Stokes is a good example where you have that crescendoing breath followed by a period of apnea. And that's very rarely a sustainable respiratory pattern. You know, it gets really bad. You can knock out respiratory function altogether. So just really securing that airway, making sure they're, you know, not having to struggle to breathe, you know, they're not gagging on their tongue or anything like that, getting that O2 therapy, assisting respirations if possible. Like that's kind of where I would start with all of that. And then as you go on, we kind of increase those, but it's just more of the same. And then the simple management follows. So obviously in the pre-hospital environment, unless things are really cool down in Australia, you don't have imaging to figure out what actually is going on. So this could be a really severe concussion, but we're going to go down the road of this is some kind of bleed. But there are some clinical signs for different kinds of bleeds, but most of the time we're going to say like, hey, there's blood somewhere in the brain. There's increased intracranial pressure and we need to do something about it. So as you go on to that, controlling the airway is number one. So if you have the ability to resuscitate them, paralyze them, intubate them, that's a great way to control it so long as you can do all of that without inducing hypoxia. We're going to want to position them appropriately. So even if we have spinal precautions in place, we're going to want to pick their head up about 30 degrees, pick their upper body up. If you have them on a backboard, you can just do a reverse Trendelenburg. And that's just to help that cerebral drainage there. Keep everything, you know, gravity is your friend. It's going to help decrease that ICP. You can look at keeping the head straight. So you don't want the head flexed in any direction. You want it straight ahead. That's a huge thing you can do to decrease increased ICP. And then we want to just reduce stimuli at all possible. Headphones and transport, if they're unresponsive, intubated, anything like that, covering their eyes, keeping the ambulance dark, maintaining normothermia. We don't want to make them too hot. We don't want to make them too cold. In these neuro cases, oftentimes they'll kind of lose that thermoregulation. So all of those things combined are going to kind of keep us in a good spot. And then, you know, that's all really easy stuff with the exception of intubation. You know, all of that patient positioning, anybody, any level can do that and have a positive impact on the patient. And then we start getting into some other things. So we have that intubation. We've got end-tidal CO2 hooked up, you know, keeping them in that, you know, low end of normal. There's some discrepancy on what people do. Old school medics will say you have to hyperventilate down, you know, to that 32 range. Our protocols right now have us keeping us between 35 and 40 on the end-tidal CO2. And that's personally what I do. And then you have, so you can do that with your intubation breathing for them. And then you have medications like 3% saline, which just help draw out some of that stuff from your brain and help kind of reduce that increased intracranial pressure.
Awesome. Well, there's a lot in there that I guess we can unpack in particular. So you did mention positioning being very important. So that sort of 30 degree head tilt that we can do whilst maintaining sort of that C-spine precaution to, you know, promote venous drainage. So there's that, then also keeping them in that sort of head forward position. How do we go about treating this patient in terms of, I know over here in Queensland, we use soft collars, New South Wales still use hard collars. So there's a bit of discrepancy there. But when we are considering the C-spine of this patient, is it important to use that collar whilst, you know, they may be unconscious? Or do we take it off and just keep their head sort of straight, maybe use towels on the side, whatever it may be? Just would that impact the venous drainage and things like that if we had something constrictive sitting there?
So, you know, and I'm not entirely sure to tell you the truth on that. We do keep our C collars on as long as they're not super tight. You're not constricting of the major vasculature. You know, that C collar, I don't think is going to have a huge impact on your patients. And you definitely do want to be protecting the C spine in them. You know, going down a bumpy road or in an aircraft or anything, I don't want to have somebody tied up at the airway just holding that C spine. That they're probably going to be busy with other things. So, for like keeping that head alignment, putting that soft collar on. Soft collars are great. Just making sure it's not super constrictive, and then you putting blanket rolls or something around the head just so that they're kind of maintaining that forward alignment, I think is the best way to do it there.
Cool. When doing airway interventions, obviously we'd go no sort of head tilt we'd keep in our triple airway maneuver. We wouldn't do that. We'd do just a double, just with the jaw thrust and chin tilt or chin opening. When doing airway maneuvers, such as over here we do LMAs, OPAs, NPAs, all of that, when utilizing an LMA, is there any risk of hitting their gag reflex and that gag reflex causing increase in their intracranial pressure?
Yeah, so like any cough or gag is going to increase intracranial pressure, and you know, we try to avoid that at all costs. So that's something you kind of have to weigh when you're looking at your patient, is how bad do you need that? You know, LMAs do a pretty good job of airway protection, but their primary purpose is to facilitate a seal, so that you're not putting as much air into the belly. You're keeping that thoracic pressure down. It's just more efficient, and you don't need two people at the airway. So, you know, if you've got somebody that might have a gag reflex, you as the provider is going to have to weigh, is can you bag them effectively and safely to the hospital, or do I want to risk putting in the LMA? Obviously, it's not an option open to everybody, but if you have the ability to sedate and paralyze the patient and put in a definitive airway or an LMA, and get rid of that gag reflex definitively before you go for it, I think that's probably where you want to be. But then again, with that route of intervention, you know, your endotracheal intubation has a higher failure rate than these non-visualized. And what's going to cause a worse outcome, a cough that temporarily increases ICP, or, you know, a period of hypoxia because you missed the tube. So, you know, these are all things I think you have to really be thinking about when you're treating these patients, is what do I have to do? What's the best thing to do? And what might I have to compromise with in this area? You know, and also maybe it's not the place for it, but like just kind of shrugging off that ego of like, if I don't show up with an endotracheal tube or an LMA, they're going to laugh at me at the ER, you know, things like that. And just trying to really look at your patient, what's best for them.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point. And I guess too, the goal of this management is to prevent secondary injury. So all the things that occur from, you know, not from that primary injury. So there could be a couple of hours to 24 hours post-injury. And so you mentioned, you know, hypoxia being one of the biggest causes of deterioration or mortality. So when talking about airway management in that sense, you did mention that some old school paramedics would like to utilize hyperventilation or hypoventilation. What are the risks and benefits of that? And why don't we use those?
Yeah, so when you decrease the amount of CO2 in the blood, you're actually going to get a little bit of vasoconstriction, which is good. It's going to actually decrease some of the pressure in their head. So, you know, you're putting them down into the 30s for end tidal CO2, 25, 20. That's going to cause good effects right off the bat. And if you have a patient that's herniating, so their brain is coming through the foramen magnum, it's still utilized as this emergency, like, hey, we just need to get this pressure down. My understanding is that after performing that, however, that's about 10 minutes of goodness that you have, that you can help that patient. After that, you'll actually have this rebound reaction to it, and you can actually cause worse increased intracranial pressure. So the way it was explained to me through my schooling was always, that's an intervention you do if either they're about to die or you're in the hallway going to the neurological surgical suite where they can actually get some of that pressure off. So with that, just keeping that end tidal CO2 in that low range of normal, I think, is probably the safest bet right now. and just not, and the key there is to not allow the hypercarbia. So anything over that 45 with it, we really want to try to avoid that because that is going to cause increased intracranial pressure. So just keeping that in that normal range and going from there.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And some things I learned as well with hyperventilation is that it'll, as you said, it will cause that cerebral vasoconstriction, but it causes peripheral vasodilation. So you will get that drop in blood pressure, which can be detrimental to a TBI patient because they rely on, I guess we'll talk about that, the equation. So the cerebral perfusion pressure equals the mean arterial pressure minus is your intracranial pressure. So if they lose their blood pressure or decrease their blood pressure, you're going to decrease the MAP, so the mean arterial pressure, and therefore decrease so that cerebral perfusion pressure that will occur. And then the second one being that if you're hyperventilating, you've got an increased risk of gastric insufflation, so increasing that stomach full of air, thus potentially causing vomiting. And as we talked about before, that can increase intracranial pressure. So those are some important things to consider as well.
Along those same lines with PEEP valves are a big thing when you're ventilating. If you're using a ventilator, you know, I'm not a proponent of no PEEP on that, but keeping that at intrinsic PEEP levels between that 3 and 5 at the max, I think is super important. Same with your BVM. If you have a PEEP valve on that, just making sure that you're not increasing that interthoracic pressure so that you're not, one, dumping your blood pressure because of, you know, vagal stimulation, all of that, but also you're promoting vascular drainage from the brain by not keeping that intrathoracic pressure up.
Yeah, awesome. That's a really good point as well. So going through that bit, do you want to explain a little bit through what the cerebral perfusion pressure is for our students listening?
Sure. So like you said, cerebral perfusion pressure is a calculated number taking your MAP and subtracting your ICP. So your mean arterial pressure, you can get that by 2 times diastolic plus systolic divided by 3. That's what I like to do for it. And that's really what I like to look at over blood pressure, especially in TBI patients, because it's so important for this very equation. And then your ICP, we might not know what your ICP is. Normal ICP is going to be anywhere between 0 and 15, I guess like 5 and 15. You know, you get into 20, that's not good. You get above 40 and we've got dire consequences there. So your cerebral perfusion pressure is basically the pressure that your body has to overcome to actually get blood and nutrients to the brain and take away the waste products. Normal cerebral perfusion pressure is going to be around 70 to 90. And that 70 is a pretty like hard stop. If we're seeing CPP below 70, that's something we have to intervene on really, really quickly in these cases.
Absolutely. And I guess because we can't calculate ICP in the pre-hospital environment, especially here that I know of, we can't. What does this equation necessarily mean from an understanding point of view when you're out on road, when you're looking at their blood pressure and they're calculating their MAP and thinking about what's happening with this patient? What is sort of that clinical application of this equation that we're using?
So I think for me, what it ends up being is that it just means you have to watch your blood pressures and you have to watch what that patient is doing. So when you have increased ICP, you're going to get into Cushing's reflex, which is going to be your hypertension, bradycardia, and irregular respiratory pattern. You go a little bit deeper into that, you're going to get some of that thermodysregulation. But right off the bat, you're going to see these astronomical blood pressures. You know, I've seen them in the 250s for these patients. And that's the body trying to overcome this bleed in the head that's causing all of this pressure. And it's trying to push more blood and nutrients. It knows it needs that. So it's trying to basically sacrifice and put that up. And what we want to do is we want to keep that regulated within a range. And everybody's protocols are different. Ours want to keep your blood pressure below 185 and above 120 for your regular undifferentiated head bleed for these patients. So controlling that blood pressure, if you can, not allowing hypotension in trauma. Hypotension is bad. So whatever your protocols allow you to do in that, keeping that cerebral perfusion pressure up is vitally important. And then not letting it get to a point where we're basically so hypertensive that blood's not moving through our blood vessels and it's not actually getting to the brain because the body doesn't really know when to stop with that reflex.
Absolutely. That's a really good point, because it's something that we get taught about quite a lot in terms of the Cushing's reflex, and it's bad news if we were starting to see that with our patients. I guess quickly going back to, because I realized we went off track a little bit, but in terms of when we talked about hyperventilating, what are the sort of the pros, cons, if there are any, of hypoventilating a patient?
Yeah, so I mean, tons of cons with hypoventilating a patient. For me, you know, number one is that hypoxia. You know, if we're not breathing enough for a patient, they're not getting enough oxygen and they're going to become hypoxic in that case, which carries with it high mortality. The second part of that is just allowing that hypercapnia with it. If we have hypercapnia, then we're going to basically just make the matters worse, make the pressure in their cranial vault even worse, and not going to do them any favors.
Absolutely. So it was good to go over that bit as well. So moving on from that part there, we'll go through the Munro-Kelly hypothesis. It's something that lots of students ask about, and quite an important concept in terms of TBI and relating it back to sort of Cushing's reflex, why that happens, why herniation happens. So did you want to run over that a little bit?
Sure. So the Munro-Kelly doctrine basically says that 80% of your cranial vault is going to be your brain matter, 10% is going to be blood, and 10% is going to be CSF. Between those three, we have a fixed space. And if one thing gets bigger, other things basically have to compensate for it. So if you've got more blood in your cranial vault, you're going to have a little less brain matter because it's going to herniate out of it. Same with your CSF. And what we really look at in the pre-hospital environment is, what can we change? Well, I can't change brain matter in their heads as much as we might want to sometimes in the field. We can't change as much brain matter as in our patient's head. Number two is going to be CSF. And we really can't change CSF with the exception of some of your critical care transfers where they have an EVD in place, where you can actually draw out some of that CSF and maintain that. Not really an option in 911 medicine or 999 medicine. And then your blood, though, that's something that we can kind of control to affect how much pressure is there. And that's kind of the one factor we have a little bit of agency over.
For sure. No, thank you for that. That's a really good, succinct way of describing what the Munro-Kelly hypothesis is. So going from there, we've talked about how important airway management is in this patient, as you mentioned, in terms of, you know, the blood volume in the head, their positioning, all of the ways in which, you know, it'd be nice to paralyze a patient and give them an airway that's more definitive. However, going on from those sort of main points, when talking about other sort of secondary injuries that can occur or conditions that may worsen the outcome of a TBI patient, some of those things can be like seizures and vomiting. How important is it to manage those types of things, and how can we manage those?
I think prophylaxis is the name of the game here for a lot of things. Our protocols will give 2 grams of Keppra right off the bat if we're suspecting a head bleed, just because we don't want them to go into a seizure. We want to pre-medicate them, and Keppra is a pretty benign medication. It's not going to cause huge hemodynamic shifts or anything like that. So pre-medicating for that, you know, if you're getting in a vehicle, just pre-medicating some Zofran or something else, whatever you carry, just to keep them from vomiting is huge. Because these are things, once they start, it's going to be a lot harder for us and a lot more detrimental to intervene after the fact, and just a lot better with really no super big downsides to treat them out in front of it. So, you know, really just getting ahead of that is super, super important, and kind of protecting that patient prophylactically.
They're really good points. So pretty sure we've gone over most of it there in terms of what are TBIs, the assessment, management, and into some of like the patho and the concepts that are important to know about when looking after a TBI patient. Are there any sorts of tips and tricks or sort of advice that you'd give to new clinicians in terms of assessing or looking after patients in a trauma sort of situation?
So I guess a couple things, and some of it I think is a standard thing to learn in school, and other things that like I'm still learning about. So in your assessment phase, and I skipped over it a little bit, went on a tangent, like I said, I was prone to do. when you're looking at the patient, looking at what how they're presenting from when it started versus now is super important. So you can kind of start to differentiate the head bleeds a little bit. If you have a patient that basically hit their head and now they're steadily declining, generally speaking, not all the time, this isn't a hard or fast rule, but generally speaking, you're looking more at an subdural bleed. You know, they're slower onset. It's a venous bleed. It's something that progresses and that could be progressing over the course of minutes, days, to weeks, potentially to these, you know, chronic conditions. Then you have your epidural hematomas, which generally occur, you know, you get hit in the head. The patient will lose consciousness initially, they'll become lucid, and then they'll start to decline a second time. That one's a super dangerous one because somebody's prone to get knocked out. They'll get up, they're like, hey, I'm fine. Liam Neeson's wife went back to her hotel room after a skiing accident and ended up dying from an epidural hematoma. So understanding that progression in it. And then the third one, third most common, at least we're talking about today, your subaracts, where you have this like splitting headache. It's just a horrible, horrible headache, and then progression from there. Those kind of are your three main ones. And then if you can kind of remember how those progress, it's just really important for your assessment. So a couple like tips in line with that, you know, were you ever taught the, I forget what they call it, but it's the test where you take like if there's blood from the ear or nose, you take like a piece of gauze and you drip the blood in it. And if there's CSF, it's supposed to like form this target pattern on it as like a test for that skull fracture.
No, I haven't actually ever heard of that. I did hear, and I don't know, I can't remember quite clearly what it was, but utilizing glucometer strips and testing that. Yeah, I haven't heard of the target pattern.
Which is probably a good thing because the target pattern sounds great in a textbook because in theory, the blood stays in the middle and it forms this target out there. But you're absolutely right about the blood glucose strip. Your CSF actually has much higher levels of blood glucose than venous blood. So if you have a baseline, which you should have checked their blood sugar, and you've got some kind of drainage from their nose or ear, you can test that with a glucometer. And if you have marked higher levels of glucose in that, you can not definitively, but pretty surely say that that is CSF fluid. Doesn't really change your treatment a ton for them, but it is something that you can kind of pass on to the doc or the ER when you do drop them off. So just kind of an easy way to differentiate that.
Now, that's a really cool piece of advice. And I guess, yeah, it's like you don't really think about, and utilizing, you know, your tools for something a little bit out of the box is really cool. I guess too, I may have missed it, but going through in that assessment sort of phase, the base of skull fractures, so like having the periorbital ecchymosis and your auricular ecchymosis as well, so like all your, so your raccoon signs and your battle signs as well. What other things are you sort of looking for in terms of a base of skull fracture, and how does that sort of change your airway management or your management for this patient?
So in general, it's not going to change a whole lot. Like you said, you see that battle signs, the bruising behind the ears, on the eyelid. Oh, one quick way to kind of differentiate that raccoon eyes on the eyelids from bilateral black eyes from whatever force it was is you can look at the very end of their eyelid. In battle signs, oftentimes that will not, or in raccoon eyes, oftentimes that part will not actually bruise, where the black eye will kind of bruise just everywhere. As far as like management, you can start getting into your Lafort fractures, Lafort 1, 2, 3, which can cause airway instability. When you're going to bag them, it's going to be almost impossible because you're literally pushing their face in with the bag. And these are patients you're going to progress to advanced airway maneuvers a lot faster. And then with the rest of that, it's just kind of informing me that something else is going on. You know, it's pretty rare that you'd have a skull fracture and not a TBI. And these basilar skull fractures, like this is probably a severe underlying TBI, and I have to be aware of that as a provider. So just keeping that index of suspicion up and being really ready to intervene and having a plan for your airway. You know, you're looking at that patient that might have a Lafort fracture and they're talking to you now, or they're at least mumbling to you now. But if they did crump, if they did go downhill, what are you going to do? How are you going to intervene? Are you going to stop at a BVM and try to do that? Or are you going to jump right to an LMA or some other device.
That's fantastic. So just going through a last couple of questions. So you mentioned at the start how important it is to go through that, you know, basic primary survey. So, you know, your hemorrhage control, airway, breathing, circulation, you know, systematic approach to pretty much everything has been highlighted across pretty much everyone that we've spoken to on the podcast. So how important is it for you and in anything you do, not just for TBI patients or trauma patients? And what would be your advice to students and new clinicians in developing that systematic approach?
Yeah, so the key with a systematic approach, and it sounds redundant, but it's to have a systematic approach. It's to have something to fall back on. You know, when you're going through school, when you're in your ride times or your clinic, whatever it is, you're around really experienced providers. And they've learned over the years, they've learned what they can skip over and what they can't. And they've got these cool, flashy assessments, and they're really quick and they're fast. And, you know, in your head, you're like, oh man, they didn't ask these questions. And it's because that experience has informed them. As a new provider, as a student coming into it, really falling back on that systematic approach you learned in school, that you learned in your assessments, where you're asking, you know, the sample questions just like one after another, and it feels like it's taking forever. It feels like it's redundant. You don't feel cool. You don't feel like, you know, you're as high speed as these people are. But at the end of the day, just keeping that and being able to fall back on that at the very least is super, super important. You know, the other portion of that is just taking a deep breath. You know, you walk into these, you want to do five things at once. And just being able to reset yourself, figure out where you're at in your algorithm, and just continuing on from there, I think is super important, because we all have this tendency to get a little bit worked up, especially in these traumatic scenes. You know, it can be chaotic. There can be a lot going on. So staying calm and just fine-tuning that methodical assessment until you do have the experience under your belt to kind of modify that to how you need it to be.
Yeah, for sure. That's pretty important, and utilizing sort of that time at uni to continuously practice, because a lot of the time students go, no, I don't want to do a scenario at uni. I don't want to stuff up. I don't want to look uncool. Like, I don't want to look like I'm don't know what I'm doing. But I think there's something good in looking like you don't know something and actually like learning from it than just sitting back and still not knowing. So that's really important. I guess in terms of a final question, what would be your biggest advice and learning for students?
My biggest advice for learning, I think, is to find mentors in your field or where you want to be. There's only so much a textbook can tell you. You know, you get out of school, you think you got a lot of book smarts and stuff, but there is a lot in the field of EMS that, you know, is really not portrayed in these texts and in the classroom. So finding somebody that can kind of guide you through those ups and downs, that can teach you nuance. You know, we talked about like old school providers doing this or that, you know, and we all laugh about, you know, boomer medics and stuff. But ultimately, there's a lot of lessons that experienced people have learned over the years that just, they might not be kosher in the textbook, but they're going to save your ass out in the field. So that would be my biggest advice. Just find people that you respect, that have experience, and see what they do, and see if they'll take you under their wing.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. Is there any way that our listeners can learn more about you and what you do, and where they can find you?
For sure. So I can be found on YouTube at PrepMedic or on Instagram at Prep_Medic. I've got my emails on both of those. You know, feel free to email, ask questions, poke fun. It's all the same.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.